There's a ballot initiative to get felons their voting rights back, but a judge could do it sooner. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Last week, a federal judge called Florida's system for reestablishing felons their rights unconstitutional. There are already plans for restoration of ex-offenders' voting rights to be on Florida's ballot in November. We're going to talk with the attorney representing the plaintiffs in the federal case. Also, South Florida is waiting to hear from Jeff Bezos, founder of Amazon and Miami native, if he's going to pick a location in this area for HQ2, the second Amazon headquarters. We're on the short list. Urbanist Richard Florida doesn't think South Florida will get chosen, and he's worried that some cities may be offering too much in the process. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, a federal judge is deciding what the process should be for felons in Florida to have their rights to vote restored. U.S. District Judge Mark Walker already struck down Florida's system as unconstitutional. Under it, the governor and cabinet members made the individual decisions about whether ex-offenders could vote. The judge said in his ruling, quote, Florida strips the right to vote from every man and woman who commits a felony. To vote again, disenfranchised citizens must go through a process before a panel of high-level government officials over which Florida's governor has absolute veto authority. No standards guide the panel. Its members alone must be satisfied that these citizens deserve restoration. The question now is whether such a system passes constitutional muster. It does not. Now the judge has asked, how should Florida do it? We're going to talk to the attorney representing the plaintiffs in this case, Hand versus Scott. It's John Sherman of the Fair Elections Legal Network, and we're talking to him now at the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. John Sherman, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So who are the plaintiffs, your clients? You know, what were they convicted of?
The nine felons in the case, they were convicted in state and federal court. Some have been through the process of trying to apply to regain their right to vote and been denied. Some are still pending in the backlog, which is over 10,000 people. And some, and at least one person hasn't yet fulfilled her waiting period, so she hasn't yet applied. But those are the nine individual plaintiffs in the case.
And how long have they been waiting to get their voting rights restored?
Some, in one of the worst cases, Jermaine Jonikins, he finished his work release sentence almost 20 years ago, and he was sentenced to just 9.5 months of work release, and he still can't vote two decades later. Many of the others were completed their full sentence, including parole and or probation back in 2003, 1997, 2002. So a long time. And, you know, some were denied in 2011 or in 2013 for merely having speeding tickets on their record. So you get the idea of how arbitrary this process is.
Can you describe what the process, what the previous process was for ex-offenders to get their voting rights restored? Because until just a couple of weeks ago, when the federal judge in this case, you know, struck down Florida's clemency board, but how did it work before?
Sure. A person with a felony conviction would have to submit an application to the Florida Executive Clemency Board. In submitting that application, they would have to compile all of their criminal records and judgments and sentences, submit that, and then they could only submit that, though, after they waited 5 or 7 years after the completion of their sentence, including parole, probation, or supervised release. So now 5 or 7 years have gone by. Now they get their application in the queue. And we've met people who have had to wait as many as 10 years beyond that point. Some of our clients waited as many as 10 years just to get a hearing before the board. Some folks do get restored or denied without a hearing. But for many offenses, many felonies, these folks have to actually appear before the board. In Tallahassee, there are only 4 meetings per year. They usually only hear about 52 cases per quarterly meeting, and the governor has absolute discretion to grant or deny these cases. He has to be a part of the majority of 3, if 3 or more, if they're going to grant, and he has sole discretion to deny. So if he denies someone, that's the end of the story.
And who was on that clemency board?
The clemency board consists of the cabinet, so it's the governor, the attorney general, the commissioner of agriculture, and the CFO. Just four people. Used to be seven, then it was reduced to four.
Did they restore voting rights to many people?
So, no. Over the last seven plus years under Governor Scott's administration, they have only restored less than 3,000 people to their voting rights. Under Governor Crist was only in office for 4 years, but he instituted a process of mandatory restoration for certain offenders who had committed less serious offenses. These people would be automatically queued up at once they were released from parole or probation, and the governor and the board had no discretion for those folks. So under Governor Crist, 154,000 plus people were restored over 4 years, and in the last seven, less than 3,000. And that's because Governor Scott eliminated that mandatory restoration process that had worked so well for less serious offenders he eliminated it back in 2011. In 2011 was when they imposed the 5 and 7 year waiting periods as well.
And what about an appeal process, for ex-offenders? I mean, could they appeal the decision of the clemency
board? No such thing. No, there's no judicial review because this is part of being incorporated into the clemency process. You know, pardons, commutation of sentence, all these things are generally unreviewable in the courts unless there is a constitutional violation. And here in court, we were able to prove that the unfettered discretion, the uncontrolled discretion that the governor and the board enjoy in granting or denying these restoration of voting rights applications, that violates old and longstanding Supreme Court precedent on the First Amendment.
Why did federal judge Mark Walker say this was unconstitutional?
So there's a line of cases going back to before World War II under the First Amendment, which says you cannot give government officials, state or local or federal government officials, completely uncontrolled discretion to grant or deny licenses to speak, to demonstrate, to circulate newspapers, to publish, to hold a meeting, a religious meeting in a park. You cannot give a government arbitrary power to switch on and switch off First Amendment rights. Now, we voting rights lawyers know that the right to vote is protected by the First Amendment. We thought at the Fair Elections Legal Network, why not use some of these other First Amendment cases and try to get at this old and really the worst voting rights crisis in America, try to attack felon disenfranchisement from another angle. And that's what the court accepted here. He accepted that these First Amendment unfettered discretion cases prohibits what Governor Scott and the board are doing, and what we should say what Florida has done for decades. This unfettered discretion in felon restoration decisions is not unique to Governor Scott. That has been there for ages, and we introduced evidence going back to Democratic Governor Lawton Chiles in the 90s. This arbitrary process is unconstitutional and unfair, regardless of who's in power, and that's what we've proved in this case.
Again, I'm talking with John Sherman of the Fair Elections Legal Network. He's joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C., and he, again, is the attorney representing plaintiffs in the case Hand versus Scott. And this was the decision that came down earlier, last week, I should say, U.S. District Judge Mark Walker striking down Florida's system in getting their rights, voting rights back, basically striking down the system as unconstitutional. Do you think, John, that politics were involved in the old system? Does the judge seem to think that as well?
Well, what the court said is that having an arbitrary process of restoration runs the risk of viewpoint discrimination, which is prohibited by the First Amendment. He cited one of the cases that we cited to him was an example of someone coming before the board, and Governor Scott asked him why he had voted illegally when he was ineligible to vote. And he said, well, actually, I voted for you. And then Governor Scott paused and said, well, I probably shouldn't respond to that. And then he proceeded to grant him. We introduced examples, though, it should be clear for everyone listening, of both Democratic and Republican governors seeming to have a little bit of a bias here when someone suggested that they had similar political inclinations or ideological leanings. Someone came before Governor Childs and said, my uncle had seen you at the Democratic National Convention, and that person was granted. Someone came before Governor Bush and said, right after Bush v. Gore was decided, and said, congratulations, 2 days earlier, congratulations on your brother becoming president. He said he was pro-life, and that person was granted. So it's not that politics, it's not under the First Amendment doctrine here, you don't have to prove that politics has infected the process or there actually has been discrimination. It's the risk of discrimination in this process, the risk of bias. That alone is sufficient to strike this down as unconstitutional. And we showed that there's evidence that this likely has occurred in the past.
How many people in Florida, and I'm wondering what percentage of otherwise eligible voters are currently affected by the old system?
So there are 1.68 million people who are disenfranchised in Florida. It's the nation's highest total. And then 1.48 million estimated, 1.48 million of those folks have already finished their full sentences, parole, including parole and probation, but still can't get their rights to vote back. And then, you know, that constitutes 10.43% of the adult population of the state. It's also the highest percentage in the nation. Something like a quarter, but roughly a quarter of the nation's disenfranchised citizens live in Florida. And the reason for this is because this arbitrary process has been going on for so long. And while so many states, 38 to date, have automatic restoration processes. They automatically restore you after release from incarceration or release from parole or probation. Nebraska has a 2-year waiting period, but it's automatic after that. Florida is one of just four states that has clung on to a process that is completely arbitrary. The only others are Iowa, Kentucky, and Virginia. So that's what we sued to enjoin in the state.
Now, the judge has ordered both you and Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi to outline for him your ideas about a better way to decide whether ex-offenders should have their voting rights restored. You've submitted those on Monday. What did the plaintiffs, your clients, propose?
So we proposed that the judge order automatic restoration for all persons with felony convictions in the state following any waiting period that is set down in state law rules. So Florida has these 5- and 7-year pre-application waiting periods. We said whatever waiting period exists in state law, and that allows for it to be modified in the future or eliminated, whatever waiting period exists in state law, once someone is satisfied that, they will be automatically restored. The governor's brief, the defendant's brief in this case, suggested that the court doesn't have the authority to impose any particular remedy in this case. They sort of argued, they sort of gave the impression that they're going to take their ball and go home, you know, that if they can't do this arbitrarily, then they won't do it at all. They even so much as threatened lifetime disenfranchisement for all persons with felony convictions, which is something they've threatened throughout the litigation.
If Judge Walker agrees with your clients, would he have the authority to order that?
We believe he has the authority to order this remedy. We asked for it, you know, and if the defendants have made clear, though, that they're going to appeal this case. So this case is not final. No matter what the judge orders in this case for the remedy, it seems likely that the case will go up on appeal. So anyone listening should understand that Florida still can deny the right to vote to felons. People with felony convictions still cannot register and vote until they're restored to their voting rights. There is also, you know, this other separate effort, the ballot initiative for automatic restoration for most felony convictions, excluding just murder and sex offenses. That's on the ballot in November of this year. So there are these two separate fronts, two separate efforts that are driving at roughly the same goal. The writing is really on the wall for this arbitrary and unconstitutional system. It's just a matter of time before change comes to it.
And what has the state proposed? What did Attorney General Pam Bondi say would be a good remedy?
They didn't really, they sort of refused to suggest what they thought would be a good replacement scheme for the scheme that's been struck down as unconstitutional. They outlined in very vague terms some of the things that they could do, the whole range of options. And at one poll was lifetime disenfranchisement for anyone with a felony conviction. And at another poll for them was discretionary reenfranchisement with certain criteria and standards. But, you know, they may, some of the things they suggest in their brief suggest that they don't get it, you know, that they don't understand what the judge has ordered here. And we may have to, they may run afoul of the judge's order in the future if they impose something that still allows for these subjective arbitrary determinations.
If you could, in 30 seconds, please tell me there's going to be a referendum in the next election on whether it should be easier for ex-offenders to have their voting rights restored. If it passes, what would happen to this case?
It would be mooted. It would be a great thing for Florida, and it would moot the case because I believe all of our plaintiffs would be automatically restored to the right to vote. And yeah, it would just be it would bring Florida in line with the rest of the country, that most of the overwhelming majority of the country, which has automatic restoration for people who have served their time.
John Sherman, again, of the Fair Elections Legal Network, and he was the attorney representing the plaintiffs in the case Hand versus Scott. And again, the judge, U.S. District Judge Mark Walker, striking down Florida's current system on getting ex-felons their voting rights back, calling it unconstitutional. John Sherman, a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you again.
And again, he was joining us from the studios in Washington, D.C., the NPR studios. Well, still to come, South Florida, one of the finalists for Amazon HQ2. One urbanist believes we likely won't get it. We'll find out why. Coming up next on Sundial, here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, there are 20 finalists for the location of Amazon HQ2, its second headquarters. South Florida is one of them. The bid is a collaboration between Palm Beach, Broward, and Miami-Dade counties. But Amazon has a list of things it has to have, and some finalists are believed to be offering big tax breaks to make their bids more enticing. Urbanist Richard Florida, co-founder of the Miami Urban Future Initiative, says that would be a huge mistake. And he's also not convinced that South Florida is going to be picked. But that doesn't mean that we lose. Amazon may still be planning something else that's big here in this region. So we spoke to Florida recently about his thoughts on the whole issue, and, well, here's what he has to say about Amazon's choices.
You know, the good news is that Miami is one of the 20 finalists. And, you know, that's one of the 20 finalists out of 238 cities, jurisdictions, communities across North America competed for this. The preponderance of those cities were in the United States, but there were more than a handful in Canada. And if I remember correctly, my recollection is correct, there was even a few in Mexico. Now, Amazon put out an RFP, a request for proposals for this, in which they were pretty detailed about what they wanted. For one, they have their current headquarters in Seattle. Interestingly enough, when many companies were moving to the suburbs, particularly tech companies, Microsoft is in the Seattle suburbs, Facebook or Intel or Apple or Google are in the suburbs of San Jose, the so-called Silicon Valley, the wonderful highway suburbs. Some people call these nerdistans, where the nerdy engineers want to live. But Amazon, since it was born, has been in downtown Seattle, originally in an abandoned hospital, an old hospital, and then in this South Lake Union area that Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft, actually acquired and developed. And in the request for proposal, Amazon was pretty specific. They wanted a metropolitan area that could accommodate 50,000 new jobs, so a big labor market and a big housing market. You have to be able to accommodate 50,000 new households. It's got to be a big place. It needed to have great universities. They wanted access to a global airport with direct flights to Seattle, Washington, and Washington, D.C., where, of course, Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post. And they wanted a range of sites. They said access by road, but access by transit. They wanted it to be walkable, where their employees could choose if they wanted to walk, drive, take transit, ride a bike. And so, you know, I actually assigned this to my MBA class where I teach up north at the University of Toronto, the Rotman School of Management. You know, we came back maybe two dozen metropolitan areas in North America fit this. You know, if you take New York and Los Angeles and San Francisco, Chicago, Detroit, Dallas, Houston, Atlanta, I could go on, you know, Toronto, Vancouver. Look, it's not a lot. But they had 238 metropolitan areas compete. Many of them had no shot whatsoever. And now it's come down to these 20 finalists, which for folks listening in, is an odd bunch. There are some places that look like natural headquarters cities. New York, well, duh. It has the largest headquarters in the world. It's always been a headquarters city. And New York has two jurisdictions on the list, New York City itself and Newark, New Jersey, the city of my own birth. Washington, D.C. has three. It has the Washington, D.C. proper, the suburbs of Northern Virginia, and then the suburbs near Bethesda of Montgomery County, Maryland. And then the rest include Philadelphia and Boston on the East Coast, a Selicarda seaboard. Miami, of course, Miami. I think Chicago's on the list. Los Angeles is on the list. Denver's on the list for sure. I think Atlanta or Dallas. I'm not sure. One or both of them are on the list. Los Angeles, interestingly enough, because it was pretty clear he didn't want a Northwest, maybe not a West Coast city. And then some strange ones. Indianapolis, Columbus, Ohio, Nashville, Tennessee, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So it's kind of a strange list, which makes you ask some interesting questions about what kind of shape the search is taking.
You're listening to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, and this is a previously taped conversation that I had with urbanist Richard Florida. He's the co-founder of the Miami Urban Future Initiative, and we're talking about HQ2. That's Amazon's name for its second headquarters. It's looking for a new location. There are 20 finalists, and South Florida is one of the finalists, South Florida being a collaboration between Miami-Dade County, Broward County, and Palm Beach County. Let's go back to that conversation.
You listed off what Amazon wants, but let's break it into what incentives these cities have to give up, possibly, to try to attract Amazon.
Well, you know, I was actually a fan of this. I sit on the board of Toronto Global. That's Toronto's business attraction unit for the greater Toronto region. We actually made the bid for Amazon, the so-called new headquarters, HQ2, second headquarters. I advised Kansas City with... It's so funny, a guy who used to be my nemesis, we've now become friends, Joel Kotkin. He's Mr. Suburban, I'm Mr. Urban. So we actually advised Kansas City. I said the same thing to Toronto. I said the same thing to Kansas City and any other city that would ask me. Compete on your strengths. Compete on your merits. Compete on your talent, your interesting companies, your transit, your roads, your universities, your technical, your affordability of housing. Make the case on your merits, but don't give incentives. Because what we know, and this is my field, is that companies typically know where they want to locate to begin with. And they kind of, they're smart. And Amazon, their site selection group is first rate.
Do you think Amazon knows where it's going?
Yes, I do.
Why go through all this?
It may not know the exact place, but I think it has it narrowed down to a list shorter than 20. And I think the 238 was a ruse, and I think there was a reason for the ruse. And I think the 20 is still a ruse. My hunch from day one, as much as I'd love to see it go to Miami, where we spend the winters, as much as I'd like to see it go to Toronto, where I spend the summers and falls and teach at the University of Toronto, where I sit on the board of Toronto Global. By the way, I offered to resign. They didn't want me to resign, but I recused myself from the continuance of the search. Because in Toronto, we made a bid with no incentive, no direct cash incentives. We made investments in workforce, investments in university, investments in talent, investments in site. Here's what I think Amazon did. I think Amazon is citing a lot of stuff. They're the fastest growing company in the world. I actually looked at a graph of how many, it looks like a hockey stick, how many things they are citing in North America in the past few years. It literally looks off the chart. They're citing logistics, warehouse, distribution centers, tech hubs, research facilities, offices. My hunch is they wanted to collect data to cite all of this. They wanted to do all their due diligence at once, and they're very smart. So they said, let's go out and on the public taxpayer dime, on our dime, have these cities put together bids where we're going to know their 10 best or 15 best sites. We're going to know all about their workforce training programs. We're going to know all about their talent pool. The taxpayers are going to pay for this. They're going to give it to us. The 20 finalists, to my mind, look like a list of where Amazon wants to cite really interesting things, not just its second headquarters. So I think the most likely place for the second headquarters is New York. I think New York is a likely candidate. Notice it has two sites, Newark and New York City. We'll come back to that. And the only place that might have an edge on New York would be Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C., because it's the head of the national government, Bezos may want to make an impact on American politics. He may be nervous about coming antitrust suits or anti-competitive legislation. He owns the Washington Post. This would only put him closer to his diamond asset. And by the way, one thing we know from the research on this is that companies typically site their headquarters where the CEO has a home. Jeff Bezos just bought probably the most expensive home in the history of Washington, D.C. He bought a $23 million mansion in the same neighborhood that Barack Obama and Ivanka Trump and Washington power brokers live. And note, there are three jurisdictions in Washington, D.C. There is Montgomery County, there is Northern Virginia, and there's Washington. I think that Boston has a shot. I think that Philadelphia probably has a shot.
And Miami?
I think Toronto has a shot. I don't think Miami has a shot. I don't mean to bust anybody's bubble. But I think Miami has a great airport and it's a great place to live, but I just don't think it has the talent. I'm being honest. I mean, I have this big, great project, the Urban Futures Project in Miami. I work with FIU. I love this place, but I don't think it has the talent that he needs. It doesn't have the talent base of a New York or Washington or Boston yet now.
So you
I think Miami's in line for a big Latin American facility, or just I think Miami's in line for something. And look, if you're Amazon and you want access to Latin America and the Caribbean, and you want a place that speaks multiple languages and a great airport and a great port, you've got to put something big in Miami. I think Miami's in line for something. I think it's probably not the real second headquarters.
Again, this is a previous conversation that I had with urbanist Richard Florida, co-founder of the Miami Urban Future Initiative. And we're talking about Amazon. Amazon now looking at 20 locations for HQ2. That's its second headquarters. South Florida is one of those finalists. South Florida is a collaboration between Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach counties. So Amazon could pick a city within one of those counties. Talking with Richard Florida, he's not really convinced that South Florida has much of a chance of being picked. But he also feels that no city should give up too many tax incentives in order to attract a big corporation like Amazon. We'll have more of this conversation coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. And let's go back to the conversation that I was having with urbanist Richard Florida. He's the co-founder of the Miami Urban Future Initiative. Again, we were talking about Amazon, and what are the chances that South Florida gets picked as the location for HQ2, for the second headquarters for Amazon? Richard Florida doesn't believe that South Florida has much of a chance, and he doesn't feel that South Florida or any city should give up too much in tax incentives to try to attract a company like Amazon. But let's let him tell us that.
So I want to come back to this idea, though, of incentives and what cities have had to give up. And this isn't new. This is like a lot of big industries, the movie industry. It's always about the incentives to attract companies. Do you think cities have offered too much? Do you think that that's a bad thing?
I think it's a terrible mistake. That's why every city I've advised, I said, don't put a dime on the table, because it really doesn't affect the location decision. It's a game that these companies play. And by the way, Amazon plays this game well. I think the data suggests that in the past several years, Amazon has been one of the largest takers of incentives in the world, oh, billions of dollars. It has a group that devotes itself to getting these incentives out of cities. What really got me going and got me upset and kind of turned me around on this, from someone who was very interested and supportive of it to someone who's been, I think, constructively critical, was the fact that my hometown of Newark, New Jersey, under former Governor Chris Christie, put a $7 billion incentive package. Now, here's arguably the poorest city in North America: homelessness, destitution, horrible levels of inequality, third world levels of poverty, putting $7 billion on the table for what is arguably the world's most profitable corporation. It made $20 billion in the last quarter. It is going to be the world's first trillion-dollar corporation. And Bezos is, by all accounts, the world's richest man. And then the governor of Maryland, another Republican, Larry Hogan, said, oh, we'll put $5 billion on the table. Now, in Toronto, I want to say this, where I was on the board, we made our bid public. We made our bid. It included no gross incentives, and we made the bid public. Many communities, including this one, Miami, did not make their bid public. I think they should. But my dear friend Bill Peduto, the mayor of Pittsburgh, I adore Bill. Pittsburgh didn't make its bid public, and the state of Pennsylvania said it should. And what really got me going is this isn't Donald Trump's deal. You know, everyone on the so-called left or the progressive community gets themselves all up in knots when Donald Trump and Mike Pence say, we're going to give incentive money to Carrier Corporation to keep a plant in Indiana. When the red state governor of Wisconsin gave Foxconn several billion dollars, the liberal punditry and progressive punditry went nuts. Well, Here is a list of the most progressive mayors, the mayors I admire. Bill de Blasio in New York City, A Tale of Two Cities, Inequality, Make Housing Affordable. Eric Garcetti, the mayor of Los Angeles, a man I think should run for president, I admire deeply, concerned about America's economic divide. Bill Peduto, my friend in Pittsburgh. Roz Baraka in Newark. Rahm Emanuel, the former chief of staff. This is, looks like the list of America's progressive political class. They're backing up dump trucks filled with billions of dollars to give money to the world's biggest corporation and the world's richest man. Something's out of whack. That struck me as so contradictory and hypocritical that I had to stand up. And so what we did is one weekend, about 2 weeks ago, I was sitting in our little apartment here in Miami Beach, and I started firing off some emails to other urbanists, people I know, people I don't know. What do you think of this? Is it terrible? Should we do something? And I came up with the idea of creating this open letter. The open letter is not to Amazon. It's directed to the elected officials, the mayors, the governors, the community leaders, the economic developers of Amazon headquarters finalist cities. And basically it says, we think Amazon has every right to look for our new headquarters. We applaud that. We think every community has a right to compete for that headquarters and compete with your best foot forward. What we don't like is taking taxpayer dollars that could be used for schools, for parks, for roads, for transit, for homelessness, for poverty mitigation, all these things that we need to pay for. That taxpayer dollars should be handed over to a rich man and a rich corporation. And so we called it, you know, I had to come up with a funny name because a mutual non-aggression pact, using that Cold War, you know, adage of a mutual non-aggression pact, urging these 20 mayors, governors, economic developers, they know one another. They know one another. They talk to one another, urging them to simply say, we're going to lay off on the tax incentives. We're going to compete. We're going to put our best feet forward. And over the course of a couple of days, 100 of the most eminent economists and urbanists, you can see it, the petitions at change.org, folks. Lord God, I looked before I came over here. We have nearly 15,000 signatures. I've never done this. I'm not an activist. So it had suggested to me that my entire field, you know, economists, urbanists, all of us, I just want to say one this. Not everyone is opposed to incentives per se. Some people are very opposed to incentives and think they're counterproductive. The words we use in the letter are anti-competitive and rent-seeking. Other people think some incentives within limits, are useful, especially for a jurisdiction that may have some issues, like a Newark, New Jersey, that may be challenged. Maybe Miami would fit this bill. But to a person, these people said, these billion-dollar incentive packages are so out of whack. The cost of that incentive would so exceed the potential benefit. And moreover, I think what the signatory said is, if someone does this for Amazon, there's going to be a chain reaction. You know, there'll be company X, Y, Z, and on, who say, we're going to have this process, and it will really be a race to the bottom. So for that reason, even though there's a range of opinions, some people are against incentives, some people are with it, we're for incentives within reason. For that reason, the fact that we're opening up Pandora's box, we got really a literal who's who of leading economists and urbanists and public policy people to sign on and say, yes, do the headquarters, compete for the headquarters, but compete on your strengths, not on public taxpayer dollars.
Look, I'm not going to speak for the politicians, but obviously it would be a feather in the cap if you get Amazon to come to your city. And they must believe that, you know what, it's going to be good for us in terms of, you know, this high paid, you know, highly educated workforce, these jobs that are going to come, and maybe Amazon will attract other companies, right? I mean,
so here's what really worries me. That's the picture. That's the portrait. That's the image. In Toronto, we attracted, with no public incentive, Google Sidewalk Labs, a company to our waterfront that didn't take incentives, has pledged to work with Toronto as a partner, has pledged millions of dollars in community engagement, taken no public money, pledged to spend its money as a partner. The backlash from Toronto citizenry about here is this big company coming to town and what are they going to do to our waterfront? In San Francisco now, the backlash, I was just talking to the editor of San Francisco Magazine who's writing about this. He said San Francisco's up in a civil war. The left and liberal activists are so concerned about what these tech companies are doing to housing prices and gentrification and inequality. One of the reasons Amazon is leaving Seattle is because the city council and the mayor started to push back. I shouldn't say is relocating a part of its headquarters. It's not leaving Seattle. Well, I want to correct that. Amazon is staying in Seattle. It's setting up a second headquarters. But it's because the mayor and the city council have so much political pressure because Amazon is raising housing costs. It's causing inequality to mount. It's causing pressure on transit. You know, I think what you could end up is the winner could be a loser. And this is why I think the point of this letter is let's hit the pause button. Let's hit the reset button. Let's take this train that's careening out of control down the track. Let's stop it and let's take something that might be bad and do it right. Here's what I'm worried about. Amazon picks a city, Newark, Washington, D.C., Miami, wherever it is. I have my own, but wherever it is. That city then puts billions of dollars in taxpayer money on the table. Amazon comes to town and the newspaper starts to write and the public radio station starts, whoa. You've now mortgaged our future on the backs of the richest company in the world, on the world's richest man. These are really affluent. And the jobs Amazon is hiring for are $100,000 software developer jobs. And they're hiring people at $15,000 a job in the cafeteria, but the gap's growing. The housing prices for the 50,000 people, you know, went up $100,000. Look at all the traffic on our roadways. And from Amazon's point of view, why, if you want to move from Seattle, where you've already caused some problems, and come to Miami or Boston or Newark or New Jersey or New York or Washington, D.C., and have a new headquarters and arrive in town and be the hero, why would you want to bankrupt that place in the first place? Why would you want that place to mortgage its future, to give away its future tax dollars to you? You would want to say, no, we want to be a partner in development. We want housing to be affordable. We want good transit. We want our schools to work. We want great parks for our people. That's why I'm saying this doesn't seem, it seems like this is going in a crazy direction. And what really worries me in the signatories, this is either going to be the example of how we do this right. Amazon does this right, partners with the community, doesn't take tax incentives, says, we're going to work with you in a partnership model here in Miami or wherever we go, to work with the schools, to work with the community, create parks, create open space, make sure we build enough housing. We're an affluent company. We can build a foundation with you. Or it's going to be the example of how not to do this.
Once again, this is a previously taped conversation that I had with urbanist Richard Florida, co-founder of the Miami Urban Future Initiative. And we're talking about Amazon and what chances does South Florida have of being picked as the finalist, as the location for HQ2 for Amazon's second headquarters. We'll have more on this coming up here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. All right, let's go back to the final piece of our conversation with urbanist Richard Florida, co-founder of the Miami Urban Future Initiative. Again, talking about Amazon and will it pick South Florida as its location for HQ2? Is Miami giving away too much to try to attract the company? Is it really going to be advantageous for us? Let's let Florida tell us all about it.
I never heard at any point that they were going to come in and help build these things. They were looking for a great place of public transit and housing near an airport, near good education. They were looking for this stuff. They're not bringing it.
And I think they're already dealing with a public relations nightmare. And I think when they get to that, first of all, when there's 19 losers and one winner, and when that winner, if that winner is now is fiscally bankrupted, they are going to have a public relations nightmare. Amazon already, you know, and I like him. Look, I get so many damn packages from that company delivered with two kids. You know, I'm a prime customer. I like Amazon. I've never been a critic of Amazon. I'm not there calling to break up Amazon. But, you know, Scott Galloway, who wrote this book, The Four, who took a big deep dive into the big four, Google, Amazon, Apple, and Facebook, he said it's time to break them up. There are people out there calling to break this company up. And I just think they can't risk it. Already, I think they're getting much more negative publicity. And I'm not trying to bring on negative publicity. I'm trying to say, let's do this right. Let's make Amazon a model. How much money do you need with a $20 billion quarterly profit? How fast do you need to get to be the world's first trillion-dollar company? And, you know, I could see one of these, a Donald Trump-like populist politician, you know, saying, look, de Blasio and Garcetti and all these progressive politicians handed over taxpayer dollars to a big company. That's not the American way. You could see in a red state an aspiring politician really making a field day with this. So that's why I think it's in Amazon's interest. It is in Amazon's interest and the city's interest to sit down. Look, we've now got 20 cities and one company. Let's sit down in a room and let's figure this out. We want Amazon to pick the right town. We want Amazon to bring these jobs, but we want to do it in the right way, not the wrong way. And that's all I'm saying here is that let's hit the reset button. Let's do it right, not wrong.
I don't know if it's a fair comparison. I wanted to bring this up with you because I wanted your take on it. I'm curious if, you know, we haven't put these tech guys on some sort of pedestal. The one example that I have is having lived in Las Vegas. Out there, before I left Las Vegas, it was all about Tony Hsieh and Zappos. He came in, brought his headquarters into downtown, wanted to basically almost rebuild all of downtown into this model of what a new high-tech city is going to be. Nobody said that they were going to be the next
Silicon Valley.
They were going to be the next Silicon Valley, but he was going to rebuild Las Vegas into this new 21st century city. He made some changes. He did some stuff. At one point, people thought, oh my God, this guy's like the mayor already. But then things started to fall apart. So I wondered, are we putting, you know, and not to compare Hsieh to Bezos, he's much more powerful, but are we putting these guys on some pedestal? We think they're going to come in and they're going to rebuild our cities and take us to a whole new place?
Yes. And so I know the Las Vegas project, the downtown project, really well. I know Tony Hsieh really well. I went there. I spent a day with Tony Hsieh. I spent a day with the former mayor. I spent a day with the city council. And I gave Tony my advice. By the way, Amazon owns Zappos. So you could almost see the Tony Hsieh project as a kind of a microcosm, a different kind of microcosm of what Amazon is trying to do. And I said to Tony, and Tony's a very interesting guy, very bright guy. I said, Tony, you've got to hire, not me, you've got to hire a great urban design, urban community engagement group to come in here and work with the community. There's going to be a backlash. You're a rich guy with a rich company. You want to do the right things. You want to rebuild this town, a part of town that, it's not the Strip. It was a part of town that was burned out, Fremont. He bought the old city hall. He started to buy up some of the old abandoned hotels. He wanted to build parks and bike lanes. But you could see, just walking around there, you know, seeing the people who are like us with their cappuccinos and their workout gear on their cool bikes, you could just feel the tension. Same thing in Detroit. Dan Gilbert, you know, my wife's from Detroit. I love downtown Detroit. I'm so happy to see it coming back. But, you know, you already see the local people, largely minority, largely African-American, who feel like they're being poked in the eye. Here come these rich white people to take over my downtown. So my point to Tony was, do a process of community engagement and do something that's inclusive, not exclusive. Well, what you're saying is this backlash since Tony started and Dan Gilbert started has really picked up steam. And that's what I'm worried about. You know, when the guy who edits San Francisco Magazine says, we've got a civil war in San Francisco, where the liberals and the progressives and the minority community want these tech companies out, and the tech company are acting like jerks, and they say, well, no, we want to build more. I really feel it's tragic because these tech companies can bring jobs. They are the source of innovation in America. They are what keeps us competitive and raises our standard of living. But it's almost like we've gone back to the 19th century and the old robber barons where they were clueless. And they were just they did things that were so stupid. And they just angered people. And we got a populist movement and a progressive movement. Now, I talked to Bill Peduto, the mayor of Pittsburgh, about their experience with Uber. And he's been a fan of Uber, and he's tried to help Uber there in Pittsburgh with self-driving cars. But he said, they're a new company, they're an immature company, they're a teenager. They're not like a company like Ford or GM that learned through the school of hard knocks, dealing with the unions and workers and communities, how to be a partner. And I think Amazon, I think they have the kind of leader in Jeff Bezos. Guy bought the Washington Post to create, you know, he calls it to make sure we have a democracy. He's a critic of Donald Trump. He's a guy who's cared about his hometown of Seattle, and he comes from Miami. I think he could help us do this right. And my only hope is that, you know, he's got advisors around him that aren't giving him the right advice. And when he really takes a long look in the mirror, he says, well, this is the way I can set an example, working with these mayors in these cities. I can set an example of how to do real urban development, how to be a real urban citizen, and how to build up my town, not bankrupt it fiscally. So that's my I'm skeptical, but that's my hope.
Let me finish with this. You think you know what city is probably going to get it, or that the list is smaller than what it really is right now, and that Miami really doesn't have a chance. But does this hurt Miami in any way? Say we don't get it, but
Does this hurt Miami? Anything that's happened, or have we learned our lesson? Should we not be giving incentives? I don't know. What comes out of this
for us? I actually think this Amazon process is good for every city because it forces regional cooperation. It forces people like the terrific new leadership of the Beacon Council and the Chamber and community groups to come together with local mayors and governors and look at their assets. It forces you to introspect about what was missing, whether that was talent or transit or whatever it was. It forces you to think about it. But look, headquarters, we know, don't drive economic development. What does is startups and local initiative and building up your own talent base and your own assets. That's what Miami's been doing with Wynwood and the Knight Foundation support. Look, I've lived here for 10 years. Not some people have lived here much longer. The amount of change I've seen in this city and region in 10 years is mind-boggling. I mean, there are very few places on the planet that have seen this much positive change. I'd say maybe only Toronto, where I spend the other part of the year, would be the other place with as many cranes in the sky and a new skyline. Los Angeles would be another example of a place that's really achieved. Look, we've done a great job. We have a great airport. We have good universities, FIU or University of Miami, go on. We are attracting talent from the world, not just from the United States. We're attracting talent, and not just from Latin America, from Europe and all over the place. So, no, I think we've got to double down. But I still think, you know, I've told every community, don't pin your hopes on HQ2. Look at this as a way to get to know, to date, I'm making air quotes, to date Amazon. Amazon's got a lot more stuff to site. It's going to need logistics and warehouse and distribution for Latin America. It's going to need a Latin American headquarters. If Miami doesn't get the big one, Miami could be in line for something better. And by the way, maybe getting second or third prize cost you a heck of a lot less. So no, I don't think this is a loser for Miami. I think we're hitting our stride. I think there's still a ton. That's what our Miami Urban Future Initiative is about. There's still a ton of stuff we have to do here. And by no means are we're not even half the battle yet. But things are pointing in our direction. So no, I don't think our future hinges on HQ2. I think it hinges on doing what we've been doing, doing the things we've been doing right, and addressing our challenges. And by the way, those challenges are leveraging our talent, increasing our talent base, spending more money on our higher education system and building up our universities, continuing to invest in our innovation ecosystem, fixing the damn transit problem or lack of transit problem here, which is ludicrous. We've got to get that one done. And then finally, overcoming the divide. You know, the divide that we have in Miami, I'm writing on this now. We're a very unequal place. We have haves and we know this. It's obvious, haves and have-nots. Figuring out a way to build our economy in a way that's not exclusive but inclusive. Doubling down on that, I think we have a nice future.
Richard Florida, always a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's great being back with you.
And again, that was Richard Florida, urbanist and co-founder of the Miami Urban Future Initiative. We talked about the chances South Florida could win the Amazon bid to bring HQ2 to the region. Now, we've reached out to Amazon for comment on his criticisms of their selection process, and we'll let you know if they get back to us and what they say. And we want to know what you think about Richard Florida's analysis. Find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial. Share your thoughts. Let us know what you think. Well, that's the program for today. Really do appreciate you tuning in. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.